I pushed the record button already.
Did you?
Yeah.
But then the noobs get to hear, I mean, the fans get to hear all of our secret background talk here at a Canadian institution. What I remember from an episode of How I Met Your Mother describes the most Canadian place in the world, Tim Hortons. Because everywhere else is closed or awful acoustics.
I think some people swear by it. I'm just kind of meh.
Yeah, I mean, my view is that it's superior to Dunkin' Donuts, but that's not a high bar. You know?
I think the one
we shouldn't talk too much smack though while we're here. We're getting stink eye.
Dunkin' Donuts near face-to-face games. I think that closed. That changed into some other donut place. They no longer have the.
That's how long it's been donuts. Since I've been to face-to-face. I remember. There were Dunkin' Donuts there. People would walk the, like, 6 blocks to go to Tim Hortons instead.
Well, welcome to Table for Two, your source for high-level strategy.
And random discussion about coffee chains in Canada.
we had some good praise this past week from someone who was on the Arena Super Cup stream. Frankly, I feel super happy whenever we get a demographic that I'm not expecting that to be French or Francophone. I mean, the common joke was when the Man Deprived Super Series went to Quebec City or these more like predominantly French.
C'est quoi Man Deprived là?
Or the thing that people love to say, c'est qui kit? Everyone loves
it. C'est qui kit?
Who's kit? And everyone loves that. And for the record, I hate it when anyone calls me kit. Kite or I can take
let's go fly a kite up to the highest heights.
I see comedic merit to calling me voiture. People enjoy that.
Yeah,
love it. Like
voiture.
Pascal
voiture is just car in French for those of you who aren't francophones. Those of you who are francophones, bienvenue. C'est la table pour deux, la tabernacle. All right.
Like Fournier likes it, Pascal likes it. I think other people love it, but like kit is off limit. Like if you call me that, that is a good way.
So
to get
basically,
on my
badness. at the upcoming throne of Eldraine pre-release. If somebody hands you is like here's your pre-release kit, you know, are you gonna tilt off and be like, don't call me that. No. It's like the airplane joke of, you know, Shirley must be joking. He says, I'm serious and don't call me Shirley, you know. But yeah, we're here for top-level strategic content. So, you know, people have given a lot of feedback, and they said that I've been really, really crappy at giving strategic content, so they want to hear more from the Arena Super Cup champion himself, KYT. So look, KYT, if you were going to teach a new player who's never knew Magic how to play, obviously, you're going to explain how, you know, how to tap your lands, how to untap step, you know, cast your spells, attacking. But after that, how are you going? What's the first thing you're going to teach them to be good at Magic? Like, to start thinking about the game strategically?
I think this is the first time in the long-running series that you're just bringing a random question on the show, on me, when I'm used to doing that. I'm the one tricking you.
But this is a good question, isn't it? I think most of the people listening are way past that point, but I think there is some value to, first of all, providing something for people who maybe aren't as advanced strategically, and sometimes there's value to going back really to the basics. You know, we talk a lot about how fundamentals are really important, and I try and stress them, but sometimes, for me, some of the real fundamentals are just so ingrained into how I think about Magic and what I do that I kind of skip some steps, you know, like if you're doing a math test and the teacher gives you partial marks for writing some steps. For me, a lot of the time, one of my weaknesses, I just write the answer because the steps are so trivial, I'm so used to them. So sometimes it could be helpful to get your perspective as someone who's also very accomplished in Magic.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I mean, I'm glad you got that thank you before I could troll you. And I wasn't actually going to troll you, but that, like, I think, you know, you're not quite at pro level, but you're the self-proclaimed second best Magic player in Quebec. So,
I mean, one of the biggest compliments you've given me, and I don't even know if you remember this, is at one point in time, you said that you think I can come up with the same plays as you. It would just take me a very long time compared to you. And that, I think that's a compliment compared to, like, just thinking that I might be able to understand or see some of the plays you make is to me high praise. But anyway, back to your question. So after a person's learned the basics,
Yeah. What is the next thing you would teach them after they know the rules of the game? It's like, imagine in chess, they learn how, they know how all the pieces move. What's the next step? The next step, I would say, if I was teaching someone chess from the ground up, would be, you know, focus on development and control of the center. So you want to use your first few moves, you want to focus on getting your pieces out and getting your pawns in the center. So, you know, you don't want to move your side pawns and move your pieces out there. You want to focus on the center, but you also don't want to just be moving all your pawns. You want your pieces to develop too. And I think that's a first step for someone to understand, you know, what you'd be doing. And you can explain that, you know, central squares give you more options and you want to preserve your options. So having control of those squares and developing your pieces increases your options, which gives you more good moves. Now, how that's already getting kind of advanced, but that's kind of how I would start, I think, if I were teaching someone chess. Now, magic.
That's very interesting. I think there's, back to chess, there's some people who like to trumpet the concept of teaching them backwards, like from the endgame to the opening. And I think, in a way, for magic, it would be, I think Ben Stark would approve, like going limited, going stripped down magic, and just for me, probably just having them understand the value of attacking someone down to zero. Like, this seems so primitive to us, but so often I've seen people with free attacks as a beginner or a noob, they just say go with a 1-1 and the opponent has no blockers. So just that is just like a huge warning sign that this guy just doesn't know what he's doing.
Yeah, I think that's a good fundamental, like the idea that, you know, the kind of classic thing, if your creature's not going to be blocking and there's no blockers for it, it should be attacking, right? I think a lot of people miss out on that. They just don't, the default should be to attack unless there's a reason otherwise, right?
Right. And I think now, again, I'm influenced with my chess background, is one of the very basics of evaluating who's winning is material, which is a queen's 9 points, a rook's 5, a knight, bishop 3, a pawn's 1. These aren't precise numbers, but these were guidelines. And of course, chess engines and chess pros, grandmasters have tweaked with those numbers at some point. They think, some advocate that the bishop's worth more than a knight, or in some situations, vice versa. I don't know what the state of computer chess is at now. I imagine the bishop is still worth more, even though when I learned it coming up, it was 3 points, and so was a knight. And I think that's where we go back to limited and having these situations where I show them card advantage. I mean, typical limited example would be attacking with a creature, and they block. You pump it with a pump spell, and then you get punished with a removal spell. Now you lose your creature and your pump spell in exchange for their removal. Now, sometimes that might be an exchange that you would want if you want to protect something else, but again, I think that's one of the earliest things that I learned, like using one card to get rid of two, and if you keep doing that, you're probably going to win the game, even if your cards are, you can make up for the fact that some of your cards are shittier by having just like two of them, so then you could use those two to trade for their superior card.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a good point. I think card advantage is also a key building block to magic, right? That's like in chess, you're saying the, you know, the point valuation of pieces. I think that is something that as a beginner you're taught all what all the pieces are worth, so that you know that, you know, trading your queen for a pawn is a bad idea. Similarly, you know you're taught in card advantage and magic that you don't want to trade three cards of yours for one of your opponents, right? But I think that, both chess and magic, that ideal only holds true to a certain extent, right?
Correct.
That basically, like, you know, like you're saying, first of all, that you're taught that I was taught too, bishop and knight both worth 3 points. But now, you know, they're thinking that's slightly different. And I think, you know, in magic, that happens too. Card advantage is still important, but it's not always the most important thing, and often sacrificing card advantage for other advantages is valuable. Just like in chess, you'll see people sacrifice material for positional gain, which I think brings to the next kind of building block of magic, which is tempo, I think, which is kind of related, I guess, to your attacking thing, but I think it's kind of much more fundamental. Like, I think attacking is part of, you know, getting your opponent to zero usually through attacking is how you win the game. But in terms of, like, understanding the game, understanding how to make good decisions, card advantage is a big one. Like, you know, you have an inherent thing, all else being equal, that you shouldn't trade multiple cards for one of your opponent's cards. And if you can trade one of your cards for multiple of their cards, that's a good exchange. Anything that brings you up resources. And then tempo is kind of more complicated. I think mana advantage is somewhat related to card advantage, but the idea that you want to be spending all your mana every turn if possible, right? That if I end up spending 20 mana over the course of the game and you spend 5 mana over the course of the game, that's going to favor me, because the way cards are designed is that if you're spending 20 mana, you're getting a lot more bang.
Yeah, you should be.
Yeah. I wouldn't say necessary bang for your buck, because you're spending 20 bucks for it. They're spending 5 bucks. You know, maybe you only get 15 bucks worth, but that's still more than 5. Because, you know, if you want, they're usually, like, let's say for 1 mana you get a 2-2 creature, right, constructed, and for 2 mana you get a 3-3 creature. Well, that's not a 4-4 creature, right, which is what you'd think, twice as much mana as a, because you're spending the card as well.
Wasn't this like a concept that AJ Soccer tried to spin as a concept, and all the pros tried to make fun of him?
Yeah, he went too complicated and started talking about things like dredge and what dredge was worth in terms of stock mana. And his basic idea, I think, was good, but his application of it was bad, and a lot of people made fun of him for that. I think, you know, in general, people don't take sometimes these things, these types of articles, and try and write about them, because they are very ambitious and it's very hard to do. And that if you fail, like AJ did there, you know, you get made fun of, and then other people see, oh, I'm not going to write that type of article. I'm just going to write another deck list, because that's what brings in the bucks. But yeah, so I think those are kind of, I think mana and tempo and card advantage are all kind of the three basic foundations of let's say the pyramid of Magic.
I will have to say a comment that tempo, like in my journey, tempo was the hardest thing to learn and grasp. Even in chess, it was tough to sacrifice pieces in order to checkmate the king, or just to gain a significant advantage in a side of the board. That, I think that's hard for a player of my level at that time. And even in tempo, you know, it's not intuitive for someone coming up with learning card advantage limited why Goblin Guide is a good card for like the mono red deck. Like, I'm giving them cards, right? And it's that's where you understand tempo a bit, where, you know, it doesn't matter that they have card advantage, because you're crushing them on a different axis. You're killing them before they can even use those cards, so those cards don't matter.
Right, exactly. I mean, for those who don't know what tempo is, it literally translates to time. So it's the fact that, you know, that, for instance, an aggro deck wins against a control deck if the control deck has enough time to get their things going. Usually it's more powerful to win, but the aggro deck can win ahead before they get to get there. You know, the fact that their spells cost 1 and 2, they get to play them before the control deck casts its 3-mana spell. Same reason why people play a card like Disfigure instead of always playing a card like Mortify. Mortify is much more powerful. Kills anything, an enchantment or a creature, anything of your choice, right? Whereas Disfigure only really kills a 2-toughness creature. However, it costs 1 mana versus 3 mana, and that's a huge deal when, you know, if a threat would die to either one of them, you can get a big tempo advantage by playing a disfigure and playing, let's say, another two drop spell, and you've gotten to cast more spells than your opponent. Kind of when it breaks down to it, tempo is probably the most complicated of the concepts, of the three kind of pillars, that, and I think one that even at the best level players don't really understand, because it's the way you kind of exchange resources for one another, right? In Magic, there's the inherent resources you have, right? Or your starting life total, your starting cards in library in hand, and you have the ability to play one land a turn. Those are kind of your restrictions. And, you know, the one land a turn is connected to both mana a bit and to tempo. In some ways, if there wasn't the land a turn thing, tempo wouldn't be as interesting, because you could just play all your lands. It would just, card advantage would be much more important.
Right.
And usage of mana. There's like a deck like, you know, Canadian Threshold, or what people call Teemer Delver nowadays in Legacy, is all about getting to cast way more spells than your opponent and kind of keeping them off balance for long enough to kill them with that tempo advantage. The fact that you can play Delver Secrets for one mana and daze their spell and then wasteland them, keeping them low resources while you are also low resource, but you can cast all your spells off of low resources, is one way you can take advantage of tempo. You know, you're not actually progressing your board state more, but you've already progressed it to start, and then you're kind of keeping both of you at in stage one. Another way is to find a point where, like, let's say Fairies decks in Old Standard, where they would play a Mistbind Cleek. Like, they'd be losing in the early game, blocking with a couple fairy tokens with their Bitter Blossom, you know, maybe trading a little bit, being behind on life, and, like, a little bit behind on board, and then Mistbind Cleek comes down, gets rid of the Bitter Blossom, so stops them from taking damage, puts a big creature in play, maybe kills a smaller creature from their opponent and taps their opponent out. And then suddenly now you get to untap with Cryptic Command up and start attacking with your Mistbind Cleek. Suddenly you're slightly ahead on board and you can hold ahead with that advantage. Basically, tempo usually is utilized in Magic, I think, of taking it, trying to prolong an advantage. You find a spot in the game where you're advantaged, and you try and keep that board state as stable as possible for as long as you can. And because if you're slightly advantaged, the longer that that holds, eventually you'll win a game with a small advantage. You know, if you have a 1-1 in play and they have nothing, and you just neither of you is doing anything because, let's say, you're both locked out of drawing cards, your 1-1 kills them eventually.
Right.
So, however, you know, given enough time from your opponent, usually they'll do something to pull out of what you're doing. Which is why, like, a control deck, their plan is to just do the most powerful things. So it doesn't matter that their opponent is doing more things. The things, they're both, you know, they're going blow for blow, but the control deck has stronger blows. You know, they're doing, their cards are worth 5 mana or whatever, of 5 mana and a card, and the other deck is worth 3 mana and a card, you know, and so every card is just going to trade for more value, and eventually they'll win. But the other decks kind of try and hold on to a board state where they're winning, which is why, like, there's often a key turn where the bigger decks kind of switch over, and suddenly it's usually shown by the point where the faster deck can't attack anymore. When the aggro deck doesn't have any good attacks, that's kind of the key turn. And if there's, like, because the turn after that, it's going to only get worse from there, right?
Right.
The bigger deck's going to just be progressing more and more, whereas the other deck's running out of resources. So usually tempo is the battle of whether, like, you'll be able to hold on long enough with the amount of resource you have, or if you get run out of resources before you can do that. Which is why I think the fact that lands exist is one of the reasons Magic in its form can exist. A lot of equivalent games that have gotten rid of lands for variance balancing reasons don't have, in some ways, the depth of strategies that Magic does, because the fact that people draw lands makes it so that, you know, the aggro decks do run out of things to do. The control decks can afford to, like, play a game plan which is to run them out of things to do.
One question I just remembered to ask you that you just reminded me of, and is the reason why I've never really enjoyed playing aggro decks in tournaments. And I guess they're the right choice and the perfect choice in some tournaments, but when you think about it, even if you have a sweet game one, game two, you're both slowing down, and we talked about this so many times.
Yeah.
That, you know, you have to slow down, and you slowing down just plays into more. I feel like somehow you're playing more into the control deck's hand, and they're going to be even more favored because of that. But I mean, on a previous episode, what we said was that what the aggro deck should do is actually to counter back that effect is by sideboarding in cards that the control deck is not as well prepared to deal with. So, whereas, you know, instead of, they might be sideboarding all these, like, 2-mana removal spells, you take out some of your crappy 1-drop, 2-drops, and you're bringing in planeswalkers. But again, like, I feel like the control deck could actually adapt to that. Like, if I know the aggro deck's bringing, like, the White Weenie deck is trying to bring in Gideons or Ajani's, I could sideboard it in a way to make it so that, like, they have, like, I feel like as a White Weenie deck, I'm just praying one of these guys stick and then I somehow win. Like at the Arena Super Cup, in the finals, it was against Esper Control, and I was just praying that. I mean, I was playing that enchantment that makes 1/1s, and it didn't feel like I was going to clock him enough, but I guess he had a terrible draw, land flooded. Just didn't feel like I had the cards to win the game.
But you did, right?
But I did.
Yeah, one of the interesting things is the fact that, you know, the after sideboard in the control versus aggro matchup, we've talked about this, the control deck tends to, like, speed up. They cut their big, clunky, you know, like, 5-mana Teferi type cards, right? Often for cards like, you know, we talk Disfigure or whatever, cheaper answers, so that they can trade one for one and then try and out-resource with some bigger cards. And meanwhile, the aggro decks cut some of their smaller things that are vulnerable to the stuff the control deck's bringing in for their bigger things like more Chandras, more Experimental Frenzy type cards, let's say, you know, or Gideons, let's say, out of the White Weenie deck. So the both decks kind of converge a little bit more after sideboard, which is interesting. It's weird. It's very interesting to think about in terms of, like, game theory and stuff. It's like the many of the Princess Bride scenes, if you've seen that movie, where it's like, you know, the famous scene where with the cups of wine in front of each of them. It's like, well, I can't trust the cup of wine in front of you because this, but then obviously I can't trust the cup in front of me, so which one is it? But there's also, like, the swords scene where it's like, oh, well, you do this, so I'm going to counter with this, but obviously if I'm going to counter with this, you'll know this and counter with that and back and forth. So especially when you kind of know exactly your list, your opponent's list, and how they're going to sideboard, how do you do it? And sometimes the idea is to, like, if you think that, if you're the control deck and you think they're going bigger, maybe you want to keep more of your big things in. If you're the aggro deck and you think they're going smaller, you definitely want to bring your big things in. But if you think the control deck's getting greedier after board, they're keeping more of their big things in. Like, for example, you know, let's say the Esper Hero decks that play Bolas's Citadel, you'd expect for them to cut those against Mono Red. But if Mono Red's just going, like, very high card advantage stuff, trying to grind out the games, maybe you do want to keep, like, one of those in your deck. But if that's the case, then maybe as the Mono Red deck, you actually want to keep your deck lean and very burn heavy if that's the plan.
Man.
So it's, I mean, that's why Magic's an interesting game. There's no clear-cut answer. There's, like, the mind game leveling there of what level do you go on. The realistic thing is that usually these grindy sideboard cards are just extremely powerful and often hard to deal with, and it's worth having a bunch of them in your deck. Even if the other decks may be better at playing that game than you are, you can hope that they, as the answer deck, they draw a bad distribution of cheap answers and big things, so that, you know, you play a couple of cheap things, and if they have a couple of cheap answers into a big thing, you're going to lose those games. But the games where they have all big things, and you'll win if you have a bunch of cheap things. And the games they have a bunch of cheap things, if you have your big expensive things, they'll lose those too. So it's kind of answer versus threat is, you know, another thing we're understanding in Magic is complicated. But I kind of want to go back to the, like, three initial pillars I was talking about: tempo, card advantage, and mana usage. And I think that basically people who happen to have, like, a style of deck that they prefer in Magic tend to be stronger in the pillar kind of that is more related to their style of deck, and maybe weaker in the other areas. So, like, for instance, if you're very good at playing, you play control decks all the time, you're almost certainly going to be good at managing, you know, card advantage. You're going to usually be good at mana efficiency, because if you're inefficient with your mana, you won't use your answers as good. But if you don't necessarily need an understanding of tempo so much, because you're always kind of behind there. You don't have to hold the tempo, because
you're just trying. Like me. I just have to Wrath of God on turn 4. I don't have to, like,
yeah,
be super precise about holding.
Right. So, like, and then whereas if you're more of an aggro player, well, I think mana usage and tempo are kind of more what's important. Card advantage is not as important for you because you're just trying to end the game as quickly as possible. You know, some wise person once said that you get infinite card advantage from your opponent being dead. And, you know, that's, it's a good point. It doesn't matter if you have nothing left. So that's often why you see players that are known for playing certain archetypes or that they do particularly well with certain things. I think it's because they're stronger at some of these fundamentals and weaker in others. And it's kind of like the guy who goes to the gym and has, like, you know, really, really strong arms but scrawny legs. You know, they haven't necessarily been practicing those areas where they're weak because tournament magic encourages you to focus on the areas you're strong and just continue doing that, right? It's like, it's like in drafting. If you know how to draft this one archetype in this draft set and you show up to a Grand Prix and it's day two and you're 9-0, are you going to draft a brand new deck or are you going to draft the deck you know how to draft?
Draft the deck.
You're going to draft the deck you know how to draft.
Right.
Even though, ultimately, that makes you worse. You're not learning as much about Magic the game. That's not what matters in that spot. What matters is maximizing your success at that tournament, not at all tournaments. So it's hard to get out of that cycle. And I was stuck kind of in that, too. I would play control decks and, like, aggro control decks almost exclusively until I kind of branched out into mid-range and aggro more and, you know, had some more success with those things. And partly because I think that's gained me a greater understanding, I think, of Magic as a game. So it's what I would recommend is when you have a tournament that's not necessarily that important, that's a good time to kind of take out one of these decks you're not as comfortable with and try it out. Obviously, you can try and practice too, but I think nothing is as good for actually learning as playing a deck in a tournament where everybody really just, like, wants to win. So, like, your local FNM's good, you know, some, like, local store where there's a real prize on the line is good. But if you're playing, if you're 9-0 at a GP or something, just do the thing you're used to. If you're playing your first Pro Tour, that's not your time to experiment. Just play the thing you're good at. But in general, I think, you know, people do very much sacrifice long-term gains of Magic for short-term. That's what, like, you know, our current era of deck lists and sideboard guides is. And there's nothing wrong with that. But you just have to understand that that's the trade-off you're making.
Right. And as you know, this cast is sponsored by Teamfight Tactics, so I have to talk about it all the time.
Well, someone in my Twitch chat today said the big fan of TFT, and I'm like, oh, yeah, I enjoy that too. And it says, no, Table for Two.
That got me.
It's TF2 for anybody who wants to.
That's why I went with the number two.
That's why we went with the number two.
No, I didn't even know TFT existed then. But in that, people just want to. I mean, they don't have incentive to really learn all the comps, if all the team compositions, if they can just learn one, build it, win. And you know, I was watching a streamer. He's like, yeah, people don't like it when I tell them to be more flexible. They like it when I give them the exact characters that they need to go after, when to level. Like, they enjoy that a lot more. And I'm going to take a shot at my man Final Nub. He listens to every episode, and I think that I've been one of his biggest supporters in terms of his brews. A lot of detractors will tell him to play a real deck, but I want him to keep brewing. But often, this is what I'm taking him a shot at him for, is he'll say that he's not good enough to play blue-white, so he doesn't bother with that. That's why he sticks to these graveyard brews, because he's in his comfort zone. I think.
Do you know why he's not good enough?
Why?
Because he hasn't tried. If you never try, you're right. Never going to be good enough, because you're going to keep learning, not, like, you know, intricacies of what you already know, but it's like, you know, there's diminishing returns on playing your same deck over and over again. Whereas if you take blue white that you've never played, sure, you'll lose a bunch with it at first, but then you'll learn a lot and start getting better at it, and you'll be better at Magic. So then you'll be able to play blue white.
Right, and I think he's someone that we both respect and think has.
No, I'm kidding.
maybe just me again. Like, just a high level of, I think he has a talent for the game and a passion for the game. And
How many coffees did he give us?
I mean, he's given us coffees.
Yeah, but I mean, for this love lecture here.
But I think it's a vicious cycle where, you know, he's doing well with Grishelbrand, Neoform. Now he's looking at big mana, Valakut, but it's not exactly, again, he's still shying away from the blue-white archetypes, the control archetypes of the modern format.
Yeah, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy is the thing.
I do want him to play just to try some of those, and maybe, I think, and then his example on the First Strike show was that he went 0-2 in GP Vegas, the limited, and he's like, no decent Magic player would go 0-2 because of how soft day one of GPs are. And I thought, me and Elliot thought he was too hard on himself on like a sample of one tournament, but it is true. I mean, I talked about on the show how I felt it was super easy to day two GPs because day ones tend to be super soft, but still, I'm sure
I mean, you know, we've talked about percentages of win percentages many times, you know. Sure, a GP, you might be 70% to win your matches at a GP, but, you know, it's not that unlikely to hit a 30% than a 30% or whatever.
Right, right.
And one of the things I think with, like, sealed GPs is that people are like, oh, sealed's all random, it's all luck. I don't agree with that, but I think that if you look at the data, I think pros' win percentage on average is higher at, like, sealed Grand Prix than it is constructed ones. The thing is, I think that it's more polarized. So, like, instead of winning, you know, with in constructed, let's say a pro's going to win 70% on day one with their constructed deck on average. It's sealed, they'll win 75% on average. But when they have a good sealed pool, they'll win like 90%. And when they have a bad one, you know, they'll win 60%. And so, like, but that's better for you as well as a player, because we've talked about this, that you want to have more polarized results. It's much better if you can have one tournament where you go 90%, one where you go 60%, then going 75% every time. Like at a tournament like a GP where you can't achieve many losses. At a Pro Tour, I'd sign in probably around 75% every time. Let's see how the tiebreakers go. You'll be like 9th or 8th every time. Probably lock that one in. But the point being, though, that you have to believe in yourself and Magic. There's some people who have too much confidence. Overconfidence is bad, but confidence is good. And if you don't push yourself to try new things and to learn more things and to believe that, hey, you know, you can play this deck, you're good enough to do it, that you're just never going to actually try, and then you won't actually end up being good enough to play it because you've never challenged yourself to that level before. So for me, like, the challenge has always been the thing, like pushing myself to learn more and do better. And so it's somewhat difficult for me to take the other perspective, but I understand, like, wanting to do well in this tournament. And I've never really been the, like, super overconfident. Like, I always have some doubts going into a tournament. I don't always do a tournament think, oh, I'm going to completely crush it. There are times where I go to a tournament and I feel really good, like I'm going to do really well. And usually those times I do really well. But there's also times where I think I'm going to do horribly and I do well. And there's times where I think I'm going to do pretty well and do horribly. So, you know, there's not that much control you have on the outcome of your Magic tournaments, right? You have to focus on your process and just, you know, what you have control of, which is what deck, your preparation, what deck you select to play, and how you play in the tournament. And if you do your best there, you need to be happy with the outcome. You need to be happy with growing as a Magic player and as a person. And I recommend trying out more decks. And I think there's a lot of people who have held themselves back because they don't believe in themselves. And I think, like, that is also a problem I had at one point, where I would always play stock decks on the internet because I didn't think that I was good enough as a deck builder compared to, you know, whoever made these decks. But then I would make these decks, like, in brewing, you know, in testing, that I would never kind of have the balls to play. But sometimes my teammates would play, and they would usually do pretty well. And finally, I started playing my own decks, and I wouldn't always do well, but sometimes I would. And that was kind of a level up moment for me, where I realized, hey, you know, I'm a person who has a lot of skill at this game. It's not, there's not just like these mythical internet people who are just like way better than me. Some of them are better than me, sure, but I do know what I'm doing, and sometimes I'm making the right decision, even if that's not the generally accepted decision.
I'm starting to think of something like how often competitive standard players often make fun of legacy players and how they're bad, and now I'm thinking of how even people who are famous for a specific archetype, a lot of them are not generally considered like top level, high level players. And I guess maybe it's because their range is too narrow and they never expanded the range enough to be considered a top pro. They're just like, hey, that's just that guy who's good with Urzatron, but you know, that's all he's known for.
Oh yeah, I mean, you listen to commentary, for example, someone playing, and they're like, the commentator's like, oh, this person's a renowned blank, let's say, affinity specialist, right?
Right, right.
And it's like, well, you know, a lot of people are, whoa, that means they're like one of the best players in the world with affinity. You know, it's like, no, like, you think if one of the actual top pros in the world, like, you know, put in a little bit of prep work and decided they were going to play Affinity because it was the best deck, that they wouldn't be the best? No, it means that, like, it means that at this one archetype, that this person is, like, world-class. They can hang with the pros when they're playing this deck. But, kind of, there's a bit of a joke within, like, the pro community that whenever you call someone a whatever specialist, it just means that they're bad at everything else. So, because especially the way commentators want to be, they want to be positive and they want to be nice towards people. They don't want to say negative things. Nobody says, oh, that was a horrible play. They just punted that game away. And it says, well, they're probably thinking this at this time. You know, like, oh, crap, oh, crap, oh, crap, oh, crap, why'd I do that? Might be what they're really thinking. But the point being that, you know, there's some value in being a specialist if you don't have the time to be a generalist. But it really pays off to, you know, we keep harping on this over and over again. Maybe it's mostly me, but I think learning the fundamentals of Magic and being able to get to the point where whatever deck's the best, you can play that deck with and be comfortable playing it because you know how to play it. For me, a big breakout moment was, I forget which Pro Tour it was in Milwaukee anyway, and Battle for Zendikar maybe, where mono red, splashing green for Teemer Battle Rage and Become Immense combo, also like Tarka's Command, was like one of the best decks. And we were testing, and this was the deck that was the best. I talked to
that would be PV, outside of my range.
PV, yeah, it was outside of my range. Yeah. I was like, PV, you think this deck's one of the best? And he said, yes. So I'm like, all right, I'm going to spend like, you know, it was like day before the Pro Tour. I'm going to spend today learning, and I'm going to play at the Pro Tour. Even though this is like outside of my comfort range, I never played X.
Who plays double combat trick, right?
Well, it's not only just like it's. Well, that part was actually kind of cool. It was a bit like Splinter Twin in some ways. That like, right, you wait for them to tap out and then boom, you just kill them. But there were a lot of aggro things of figuring out, like, you know, you lose two creatures in this attack, but you get three damage through, so that like in two turns you can top deck a burn spell or whatever to kill them, and things like that, or like, you know, how do you sequence your things to get the most damage through? How do you play around a sweeper without putting too much? And I actually found that I loved playing the deck. I had a blast playing it, and I did pretty well. I came top 25. I lost to the grandfather of Canadian Magic, John Stern, who lost to John Finkel, I think, in a match where maybe he would have been able to top 8 or something. And he finished in the top 25 as well. I remember John Stern. And PV top 8 with the deck. We had some people not do as well because the deck wasn't great against Jeskai Black, which was one of the breakout decks in the tournament. But I even played the deck the following weekend at GP Quebec City because I enjoyed playing it so much, and I felt I was learning a lot, which is one of the reasons I enjoyed it a lot, was I really enjoy learning. And I think now, you know, since then, there's been a lot of times I think playing an aggro deck was the best choice. Someone like Shaheen Sarani, I played against him 3 Pro Tours in a row or something. He's always playing some Torrential Gearhulk nonsense, and I was playing like Mardu Vehicles or like, you know, Red-Black Aggro or whatever. I forget, some other maybe aggressive deck. And every time I just beat him because I'm just playing a way better deck. And he's just like, I don't know what happened. Like, I just didn't have the right answer for your thing. It's like, well, that's what happens, you know. And I wouldn't have been comfortable, and I had a lot of good results with those decks, you know, because I think I was comfortable playing them from that experience playing
Red Aggro, and I got to build on that and do better and better. I also had a similar time where I wouldn't, for a long time, I didn't have success with mid-range, and like Mono Black was one of the best decks. I was playing the Sphinx's Revelation deck, which was also great, but there was a point where I think the Mono Black deck gained enough like from the second color to pull it ahead, and well, the green black deck is what it was with like Nissa.
Yeah, holy.
And I played that at WMCQ. It was the first time I played the deck, and it was great. It was a wonderful deck, and that's when I'm like, wow, you know, I understand the appeal of mid-range. And a lot of these times, you know, I hadn't really felt that comfortable playing these archetypes before and hadn't really understood the appeal, and it just took like one solid deck to realize it, and now I'm comfortable playing those decks. Like, I had a great result with Teemer Energy, which is classic kind of mid-range deck, and I practiced with that, and that was one of the Pro Tours I felt the most prepared with. Now, I didn't make top 8 or anything, but I came 16th. Pascal Maynard was playing his refurbished deck and came second, but, you know, I felt really good about that, and, you know, I had an excellent result, and I think, you know, me from even like 5 years ago would not be comfortable playing like an aggro deck or a mid-range deck, and that's a big way I've grown as a player.
So I
recommend people just try things out.
So to summarize some of your points, we talked about, you know, the building blocks, some of the three key pillars, why certain people might be weak and why they stay weak and what they should do to improve themselves as a Magic player. I did want to mention our frequent listener, Alex Magilicon, who was the subject of the renowned, known for deck archetype. It was debate on Twitter. I think it might have been Cedric Phillips or someone tweeted out that he was the best Affinity player in the world just because of his GP results. And perhaps he had a PT result as well for the deck. I'm not sure. He could tell us when he listens.
I don't think he had like a top 32 because I think him and John Stern for a long time were the only players eligible for Hall of Fame without a top 32 or something.
but then like I think it was Cedric or someone tweeted out that he was the best, and then someone's like, no, he's not. And then there was a debate. But I think one thing that we didn't mention, and I'd like to just quickly mention, is that people. I guess people want to be known as a specialist because they get that attention. Like my friend Attila Furr, won GP Calgary with Scapeshift, is known as the Scapeshift expert. There's the face-to-face games Edmonton Open, and he tweeted out what Scapeshift list should I play, and people are like hyped about him playing Scapeshift. I think like for some people that's something like I wanted to be like the probably at one point the Kago expert or whatever, and I think that's the vicious cycle of like the Neil brand, and I'm not helping by calling John the god of the graveyard either.
Well, the thing is, you are, because a lot of the reason you want to be a deck specialist is because right now the world of Magic is very much a world of clout. Clout is super important. It's much more important than necessarily how good you are. And there's very few people who can be one of the actual best players in the world, right?
Right.
Like, you know, I think with Alex Magiton, shout out to him. And for the record, he's an excellent Affinity player. I tested with him for a Pro Tour, and he played incredibly well and kind of blew my mind a bit, actually, in one match. Whoa. He played where he sandbagged a cranial plating forever against when I was playing a deck till I finally tapped out and then, you know, could land it. Where against most players, I'd be like, oh, there's no way they have it. They would have played it here. But anyways, there's not that many people who can actually be one of the top best generalists. The reason is partly because not everybody tries. But it's also valuable to be a specialist in something because of the clout and the fact that you can monetize being a specialist in something. You can sell your deck list. You can sell your sideboard guide. People know about you. Craig Wesco has made a career basically out of being the White Weenie guy.
Right.
Right? You know, people would want to read his articles and see his sideboard guides for that. Would Craig have necessarily been as successful if he played a variety of different decks? Honestly, he probably would have done better at the Pro Tour level, whatever he might think. I think he believes that he gave himself the best chance by playing the deck that he knows the best. But I think if he'd widened his range, he probably would have done better. Maybe he would have gotten into Hall of Fame at this point. He's, you know, borderline candidate. But he probably wouldn't have had as many, let's say, writing opportunities, and not as many people would know about him. And just using him as an example, And I think that's more and more the case what Magic is about, especially if people are trying to monetize their expertise in Magic. You know, I was just talking with you earlier that this cool new initiative I've seen, like some SCG star thing with Dylan Donegan and Oliver Tomiko, who are offering coaching and some kind of access to their lists and sideboard plans for a certain amount of money. And that's valuable. You know, they're billing themselves as, like, you know, the young stars of the Star City game circuit. That's, like, that's why you go for them. There's other people, you know, who've had a lot of success there or with a certain archetype, and they have Patreons, and they have access to their deck list and sideboard guide, and, you know, other people who are providing coaching, and, you know, often with a specialization. You see these Spikes Academy things. Ben Stark gives a course on Limited. Reed Duke gives one on, like, Modern, or Jund specifically, let's say. And, you know, both those players, for example, I think could give you a course that for almost everybody would be useful in a wide variety of topics. But, you know, Ben Stark, one of the reasons, you know, I think that he has a huge amount of people following him on Twitch and watching his stream, he's very good at what he does. But the fact that he's got this clout for being the best limited player in the world, partly from when he teamed with LSV, partly just from that's become the narrative, and because he loves playing limited all the time, people are like, he's the limited guy, he's the one I want to watch if I want to watch limited. They tune into him.
Right.
And that's more and more in our Twitter and clout-centric world. In some ways, that's important. So if that's what you value in Magic, if that and, like, you know, making money for Magic is your goal, especially for Magic content, I think specialization is very valuable. If winning games of Magic and just be leveling yourself up is what you're trying to do, then I would recommend learning a variety of things. Honestly, it's worth learning a variety of things anyways. You can still decide then afterwards what you want to specialize in.
Right, right. There's no say you can't do both, but I was trying to think, like, maybe there's a flip side to it. Like, for you, wouldn't you want, if you were forming a team, I think we've mentioned this, that, like, you would want certain people that specializes, especially in stuff that you're not good at?
To a certain extent, right. Yes. I mean, there's a huge advantage if you're, let's say, you're testing for a Modern Pro Tour, or whatever they call it nowadays. And yeah, if you can pick out a whole bunch of people, this person's expert on every, you have someone who's an expert on every archetype, that's valuable. It's not really realistic to exactly get every archetype. So at some point, you know, you don't have an expert on Living End, let's say, on your team. You need someone to play Living End against somebody who's an expert on their deck. Well, you know, turns out you get, let's say, Alex Magilton. He's playing Affinity against someone who's, let's say, we'll take Final Nub, who's the god of the graveyard. But he's playing, you know, Living End. It's a graveyard deck, but not, you know, he's maybe more a demigod of Living End. And they play a bunch of games, and they come to you and they say their conclusion is that Affinity is heavily favored against Living End. What do you use with that data? If you're finding out how Grishelbrand versus Affinity is, and you have John and Alex playing that matchup, and they come and tell me how that matchup is, I'm going to believe them. That's good, trustable, usable data. But when you have a disparity in how good someone is with versus some, you know, John, let's say John is playing Living End at 80% instead of 95 or whatever, when Alex is playing Affinity at 95 or whatever, or 99.
Right, right, right.
So, you know, how much percent of that matchup in the data is swung by that? You know, one player could think this is horrible and actually be completely wrong. It's like the story of Vincent Thibault, our old friend, one of the first writers for Mana Deprived. I think him, you, and I were the kind of the original three for that. I was, like, the editor, he was the first writer, and you were the face of a nation. But he played Pro Tours before I did. He recently requalified. But one time I was helping him prepare for extended Pro Tour in Amsterdam, the one Paul Rietzel won. And we're testing Ad Nauseam combo versus Pyre's Mantra's Ascension Punching Fire combo. And he played with Ad Nauseam, I was playing with Pyromancer Ascension. We played a set of 10 games. I won all 10 with the Pyromancer Ascension deck. He said, I think this matchup's just really bad. It's unwinnable. I'm like, well, let's switch sides. Let's see. I don't think it's necessarily that way. Then I beat him 10-0 with Ad Nauseam, with him playing the Pyromancer Ascension deck. So now, obviously, we still laugh about this a bit because, you know, it's pretty funny to turn out for both sides. You know, but, and then when we switched again, suddenly, you know, the actual thing was that the ad nauseum deck was favored, but you had to figure out how to play it. You had to know what matters and how to approach things. The fact that, you know, you need to know exactly how much time you have and to go off not as soon as possible, but once you have a bunch of ways to fight through interaction. And without that knowledge, you just have, you know, we could have been completely skewed data if it wasn't, if it was, you know, if we just played that first set of matches and we're like, we're done. So that's one of the downsides of having specialists that, you know, they very much know their deck, but they don't actually know the other decks. And sometimes they know their deck too well that other decks are just going to perform poorly when someone's picking up a new deck, like a Brew, for example.
Yeah, you're right. You probably don't want a specialist in a way. If you're like playtesting against them and you want them to play like, you want to playtest against a variety, even if a small variety of decks, then you can't really trust them to pilot anything else if they're just like really good at one specific thing.
Yeah, like on a team, you do want people all working on a variety of things. You don't want everybody working on the exact same thing. But it's also important that you have the ability for people to all work on the same thing when you identify what's good. You know, usually in the last couple days, you want to have some kind of agreement with the team that we figured out this is the thing that we should be focusing all our efforts on. Like recently, let's say Hogak would be the best deck. It's like, look, we figured out Hogak's the best. Let's come up with the best list of Hogak. Are we going to play main deck, Leyline of the Void? Are we going to play Hedron Crab? Those types of things, and you can work on that and figure out, you know, how do we approach mirrors? How do we play them? What's important? And it's hard to do that when you have people who can't just play anything. People who are like, oh, I only ever play Control X. I'm just playing Blue-White Control X as well. You know, that's just not good right now. Like, and it's not useful to play Hogak. Sure, you can test Hogak against Blue-White Control. You have someone good who's going to play that. But it's important to have a wide variety of things. And so you kind of want a little bit of a mix of certain things. You want... It's nice to have specials because then you have a backup deck if kind of the teamwork doesn't work out. But team dynamics are complicated. Nobody's really completely figured that out.
Okay. So let's slowly get out of here.
Yeah.
Getting kicked out of Tim Hortons. And
with a sorry, of course, you know.
I am going.
That's the one thing I miss about, you know.
Oh, we gotta go through the other side.
About, you know, when you're visiting the United States, there's like, you don't have to go home, but you can't stay here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I wanted to finish the show by just finishing the thought I had about the sideboarding.
You wanted to finish the show? You're sick of me already.
the point is, the whole, yeah, from the controls perspective, and let's be honest, at the MCQ level, we're expecting people to probably sideboard the same, like 85% plus of players will follow a guide, like the White Weenie guide, I wasn't straying from it too much. So from the control perspective, I feel like you could get an advantage and not go necessarily, especially if you know how the typical sideboards are, what they're gonna do. You can actually adjust for that and gain an additional edge, which is kind of something I've never done before. And I think about the Jim Davis match, and I watched on stream, where post-sideboard he was mono-red, and obviously you sideboard, I'm not advocating that this is right, but at the time he sideboarded out all of his Dreadhorde, Commander Dreadhorde, but the game got so grindy that like the mono red player wasn't killing him for 10 turns or plus. It was going like draw go multiple times, and like at any point if he drew a Commander Dreadhorde he would just win. And it's like, wow, that made me think that, hey, sometimes if the opponent is going too grindy, you can keep some of your slower elements in and get percentage points that way. That's what opened my eyes.
Like for instance, in one of my MPL matches in the previous league, I was against Christian Hauk,
and he was playing mono red, and I was playing the four color Command the Dreadhorde deck. And like I expected him to be grinding more post sideboard, so I kept in a copy of Command the Dreadhorde.
Oh my god!
And I actually just returned like three of his creatures, and you know that provided enough pressure that because my life total wasn't really under pressure.
And they never expect you to have any copies post-board.
Right, right. You expect, why would you have any of that card? Did it cost, you have to lose life, right? Says, well, but, you know, I returned a bunch of things and boom. So, like, whether it's right or not, you know, that's depends exactly on what they're sideboarding, how they play the games too matters too. That's something that I think people undervalue, and one of the things a sideboard guide's never going to tell you is that, like, you know, a classic example I think is like Luis was playing some matchup where, you know, back in Cobblade era, where you normally sideboard out your Jaces because they can just attack them and kill them really easily. But his opponent was never attacking his Jaces, was just doing 3 damage to him or 4 damage to him instead. So he kept it as Jace's post sideboard and won with them, just getting, because, you know, it's a great brainstorm engine. And there's similar things to that. You can, you know, if your mono red opponents are playing a game where they're focusing on just killing off your creatures way more than like stockpiling burn to kill you, you get to have more life total, which means they're playing a grindier matchup. So a card like Command the Dreadhorde's more valuable because they're less likely to have enough burn to kill you because they've used it on your creatures. Like, that exact scenario doesn't necessarily happen, but that's just kind of an example of... let's walk this way while we talk.
I thought it's too sick, though, that I just came up with that example of this random game, and that you've done that thing where I just... Like, this wasn't planned. Just, I didn't expect you to... Like, I expect everyone to no longer have Command the Dreadhorde.
We talked about it in a previous episode, man. You got to be unpredictable. And that holds even more true the higher level you get. Like, especially when deck lists are known, having one-ofs in your deck that they might not expect can be huge. I know, you know, I would used to get tilted when somebody would play a card against me post-board where I'm like, why is that still in their deck? Or whatever,
right,
you know?
Right.
And it's a blowout. Like, sometimes it's interesting that cards that are bad game one are actually good post-board because of how your opponent sideboards. Like, for example, let's say mono-red has 4 Experimental Frenzies in the main deck.
Correct.
But let's say they were a sideboard card, right?
Right.
And they're just like, we're all basically all creatures and cheap spells game one. Spell Pierce is a card that would just not be good there. But if they're boarding in 4 Experimental Frenzy, post-board, the Spell Pierce might actually be good. So you would want to keep them in, even though they were bad against how their deck was configured in the first game. So these are things you kind of need to think about.
And I think this is a part that people don't think about, is not talked about enough, for sure. This type of sideboarding thought process that we've just covered on the show alone, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly people do not factor in enough how their opponents play the games. And I think usually sideboard guides cover the fact that their opponent's deck changes post-board. Though, frankly, most sideboard guides are just really not that well thought out of. Like, I've seen how the sausage is made, and I know the amount of effort a lot of people put into some of their articles. Some people, you know, let's say write an article every day or whatever, and they just pick a deck list online and they say, this deck has 4 Snapcaster Mage. Snapcaster Mage is really good because you have a bunch of cheap spells. And, you know, in the sideboard they're like, Celestial Purge, this should come in against black and or red decks. It's like, you know, and then they sideboard like, oh, you know, you bring in this land destruction card against Tron because of this or whatever, you know. In the Tron Mirror, you should bring in this, but they don't, you know, they don't think, oh, their opponents also bring in this, so you should all have, because they have, like, Ghost Quarters, and you're Ghost Quartering them, you have Surgical, but do you think about the fact that they're going to have Surgicals, so they will Surgical their own thing to counter your Surgical? And, like, games like, you know, that's a pretty interesting dynamic that happens.
Okay, now I'm even more confident that I'll defend my title as the Arena Super Cup champion.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I believe, like,
you know. I just feel I've leveled up on this talk alone, and...
Oh, no, you've leveled up in many talks, but I was unsuccessful, though, in getting you to be the main talker this episode with my beginning question.
Oh.
I still ended up...
This is your topic. You're passionate about this topic. I think I talked a lot last episode because I really or questioned you a lot because I was really passionate about that topic of deck selection, and I'm always about the math. Because one thing, okay, one last thing before we end the show. I was about to write this article, and I was telling you this was like one of the first articles I was going to write, and you thought the thought process was interesting. But now, looking back, if you remember it, the idea was probably garbage, which was...
Well, we remember that interesting is code for bad, right?
Okay, true. Which was, I was coming from chess and being a computer chess enthusiast, I was just trying to port that thought process into a way to think about magic, to say... Like in chess, where people who play chess, what it would be like, there's different numerical values that you can assign outside of just material. There's, let's say, space. Some people associate value, the space behind your pawns. You add them all up to create a value. The number of pawn islands, isolated pawns and stuff like that. And then the chess engine would give your position, it gave a position a number. So plus or minus, depending on who's winning, and it would make its future moves based on that. Like this move would bring my position to a +5, but this one +3, so obviously I'm gonna do the +5 move. And the article was just like trying to view magic in a way where cards were like, you know, all worth one, but they would just fluctuate in value over time and depend on context. But because there's just so many factors in magic, it would just be impossible to view it that way, which is why, like, and the advantage board that they tried to do on stream is just like a vague estimation by whoever the caster is. It's like, okay, I guess they're winning by this much. And as I'm sure as professional magic players, you don't think in terms of those numerical values. You're just like, it's just maybe at the very deep level of your brain, it is numerical, but it's not, you're just like estimating the value, right? Like
a little bit. Like one of the things is that all these ideas, like these, where you assign values to things, like, it, you know, for some chess where pawn's worth one, bishop and knight are worth three, rook's worth five, queen's worth nine. These are like shortcuts, right? And we've talked about how shortcuts are valuable when it comes to magic, partly because, you know, as you were saying earlier, that you and I could often come up with the same play, but it would take you a lot longer. That, you know, you have time is a big factor in magic. Like, you know, we maybe don't have perfect rules for slow play and so on, but the fact that you have to make a decision that's often very complicated in a very relatively short amount of time is a big restraint. And so having these shortcuts helps a lot. However, it's important that, you know, when you learn these shortcuts and you're beginning these kind of you learn them as rules. Like, you know, you never do this, never do that, always do this. And those are very useful for helping you level up to the middle. But you have to remember to, like, you know, that it's like a shell. If you're like a hermit crab or whatever, and you've grown, and you need to cast that shell aside and find a bigger one. And as you get level up more and more, you realize that there really aren't any hard and fast rules. That the only rule is make the play that gives you the highest chance to win the game. And sometimes that goes against other rules, you know? Just like how the golden rule of magic is that if the rules of magic are broken by a card's text, that the card's text takes precedence. And it's kind of like that. If, like, the board state demands it, you can do some kind of weird thing, like destroying your own creature or whatever, right?
But that's why magic is so complicated. I think in chess, like, you look at in computer evaluation, the numerical value, you're like, yeah, makes sense. In magic, sometimes it's just like, I don't actually know what, I know sort of the vague values of everything, but I don't know which is better than which, like what part of the board hand, what part of the plan is more important at this current time. And,
A lot of your shortcuts try and lead you towards understanding what is the most important, but they're not always right, right? They're a big time saver 99% of the time, but 1% of the time you have to actually process things, which is why, like, they're, you know, I like to think, I guess this is a deeper topic that I remember that I'd wanted to talk
about.
Yeah,
I thought we were going to cover it.
Which was the fact that, like, basically, your success in magic is a combination of, like, how much is either how much you work or how good efficient you are at thinking about things. You have to either think about something over and over through practice or figure it out right then on, at the spot. And usually it takes longer than you actually have access to on the spot unless you have a really good set of shortcuts and efficient things, which is why, like, even, you know, Magic's so complicated that even the best players like John Finkel still are rusty without preparation for a little while. They need to do the preparation so that they come to these scenarios and they can figure out what they normally want to do. They have kind of half the work done, so then they can figure out the exact details and just work on those instead of on the broader picture.
All right, with that said, time to go home and support us.
Or Esports Central.
Support us. We're seeing all these Patreons and all these different things for Cyborg Guides, and even Jerry on the Arena Deckcast said, like, his metrics show that people want more, like, deckless focused content, and that's why they don't do as many level up podcasts as us, which is why, well, we constantly do these high level stuff, and if we just hope the demand's there, because clearly people who have top 8 at SCGs and other more notable Pro Tour champions have told us that they've learned a lot from our show from the very beginning, because these are lessons that apply to these are like evergreen lessons, which is great. I can tell people to go, if they love our show, to go back to episode 1 and start from there, because even though we talk about, like, let's say how you did on certain events, there's I try my best to make sure that each episode contains high level evergreen stuff, and
by asking me to talk about it, you mean?
Yeah, by asking.
And I do my best by actually talking about high level evergreen stuff. I tried to get you to do some work this time, because my sister listened to a little bit of a podcast and she's like, does KYT ever talk on it? And I'm like, or is it just you? And my mom's like, well, it's him they want to hear, you know? But no, people love some KYT too. Wanted to give a shout out, by the way, to Sergio Ferry for giving us a bunch of coffees, and an anti shout out to @plastipa on Twitter, who said, was asked, you know, what's your favorite Magic podcast? And said, Table for Two and Arena Decklist podcast have to split the finals. Hey, if you've been listening to our podcast, you know, very anti splitting the finals.
That's true.
You got to battle it out, win or lose, but you got to put yourself out there into the arena.
And I thought we've stressed there's a right order to this also.
Yeah, that if you're going to mention us, you put us number one. All right. Otherwise, it's okay. You can say, like, well, I would mention Table for Two, but they're not actually my favorite. That's fine, you know?
All right. Thanks for everything. Thanks for all the coffee. And
you're welcome.
Ship some coffees for our next episode.
Yeah, really, KYT, he's running out of space to go. Like, normally we're in a cafe or something. Now we're literally on the street.
We are on the street.
He's been brought to homelessness for this podcast, you know? He's feeling like Mike Flores and Brian David Marshall right now, talking on the busy street.
So, good luck to everyone's MCQs this weekend, or SCG Syracuse.
And yeah, and actually, let us know if you're interested in us maybe doing a series of Zero to Hero, of, like, working from somebody who's kind of just learned Magic to how to become, like, a winning PTQ or MCQ player from learning fundamentals.
Like, lesson-wise, or are we going to have a noob as a guest? Okay.
Ooh, we could get a noob as a guest, too. In fact, we could have a Charlie and Chocolate Factory golden ticket thing that everybody who sends us a coffee gets entered into a raffle.
Oh, that's not bad. Okay, if there's interest for that, definitely tweet at us.
And maybe second place gets private coaching session with KYT. So
on Magic, on medium level Magic and high level social media marketing.
Yeah. KYT's reach is in the millions, man.
All right. Talk to you guys later.
Peace. Parkour.